Was it Cesar Chavez or Rosa Parks that day? Some say Dr. King or Gandhi that set them on their way. No matter who your mentors are, it's pretty plain to see that if you've been to jail for justice, you're in good company. Have you been to jail for justice? I want to shake your hand, 'cause singing and lying down are ways to take a stand. Have you sung a song for freedom or marched that picket line? Have you been to jail for justice? Then you're a friend of mine.
Hey, you law-abiding citizens, come listen to this song. Laws are made by people, and people can be wrong. Once unions were against the law, but slavery was fine. Women were denied the vote while the children were the mine, yeah.
The more you study history, the less you can deny it.
Say a rotten law stays on the books till folks with guts defy it.
Have you been to jail for justice? I wanna shake your hand, 'cause sitting in and lying down are ways to take a stand. Have you sung a song for freedom or marched that picket line? Have you been to jail for justice? Then you're a friend of mine.
Well, the law's supposed to serve us, and so are the police. But when the system fails, it's up to us to speak our peace.
We must be ever vigilant for justice to prevail.
So get courage from your convictions, let them haul you up to jail.
Have you been to jail for justice? Won't shake your hand, 'cause sitting in and lying down are ways to take a stand. Have you sung a song for freedom or marched that picket line? Have you been to jail for justice? Then you're a friend of mine. Have you been to jail for justice?
Have you been to jail for justice?
Have you been to jail for justice? Then you're a friend of mine.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can hear this program at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area, or you can hear it on accesssacramento.org, or you can download it from greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com, and it's on Facebook. Today's program is a debate: does income inequality impair the American dream? Income inequality has been on the rise in the U.S. for decades. The top 1% of earners in the U.S. now held a much greater share of national income than three decades ago. At the same time, incomes for the bottom half of American households have remained virtually flat.
Hello again from Intelligence Squared US. I'm John Donvan. We use the word dream sometimes to mean almost completely opposite things. We use dream to describe an aspiration for something that can be if we try hard enough. Dream a little dream. I have a dream. But we also use it in the opposite way to describe something that just is so impossible to get that it's ridiculous to try. You know, dream on, buddy, in your dreams. So what about people who are partway down the ladder of success in America and their American dream? Given that 40% of America's wealth, up to 40%, and up to 20% of its income is in the hands of the legendary 1%, does the dreamer on the ladder still have a chance to climb, or should he or she simply dream on? Well, that sounds like the makings of a debate, so let's have it. Yes or no to this statement: income inequality impairs the American dream of upward mobility. A debate from Intelligence Squared US. I'm John Donvan. We are at the Kaufman Music Center in New York City. We have four superbly qualified debaters, two against two, who will argue for and against this motion: income inequality impairs the American dream of upward mobility. As always, our debate will go in three rounds, and then the live audience here in New York will vote to choose the winner, and only one side wins. Let's meet our debaters. Please, ladies and gentlemen, welcome Elyse Gould. And Elise, you're a senior economist and director of health policy research at the Economic Policy Institute. And one of the topics you you study there is wages. You have a calculator on your website, I'm told about. I haven't been to it yet. But it shows what your wages would be today if they had actually kept up with productivity. So that $40,000 today really should be something closer to $60,000. That's about right. So when that was posted on the website, did everybody at the Institute ask for a raise?
Well, not immediately, John, but we economists really know how to bring the facts to the table when we start bargaining over wages.
And you'll be bringing some facts tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, Elise Gould. Elise, tell us who your partner is.
My partner is the charming and resourceful Nick Hanauer.
Ladies and gentlemen, Nick Hanauer, please welcome him. Nick, you are also arguing for the motion, income inequality impairs the American dream of upward mobility. You are you are clearly a one percenter. You're a venture capitalist. Way back in the 90s, you made an investment in a little company called Amazon.com. It worked out. You recently wrote a memo to, as you put it, your fellow zillionaires, where you warn them that these high and historically high inequality is not only self-defeating, that it's transforming us into a feudal society. How did your fellow zillionaires respond to that?
Well, I live in Seattle, Washington, and I reckon you have to go all the way to Texas to find a serious and intelligent, wealthy person who doesn't agree that rising inequality is something that we need to address.
Yeah, three cheers for Texas. Thank you, Nick Hanauer. That's our team arguing for the motion, ladies and gentlemen. And we have two debaters arguing against the motion, which once again is income inequality impairs the American dream of upward mobility. Please welcome Ed Conard. Ed, you are a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, former partner at Bain Capital. That makes you also a one percenter. Author of this book, Unintended Consequences, Why Everything You've Been Told About the Economy is Wrong, in which you actually explain how society benefits from the wealthy. Ahead of publication on this, you were profiled in the New York Times. The article predicted that this could be the most hated book of the year. Was it, Ed Conard?
Only in my wildest dreams do I have that much impact on the national debate.
Well, see what happens after tonight's debate. Ladies and gentlemen, Ed Conard. And Ed, your partner is?
Scott Winship, a renowned poverty scholar, formerly on the left, now on the right. He's examined the data for quite some time and has gradually come to the other side of the divide.
Ladies and gentlemen, Scott Winship. Scott, as your partner just said, you're also arguing against the motion that income inequality impairs the American dream of upward mobility. And as he pointed out, you're at the Manhattan Institute, a relatively conservative think tank, but you were once part of ACORN, the liberal community organizing group. So being at the Manhattan Institute now with that background, how do you describe yourself?
I suppose I'm a libertarian. I don't know. My mom describes me as handsome.
Well... Scott Winship, ladies and gentlemen, and our team arguing against the motion. Let's get on to round one. Our motion is this: income inequality impairs the American dream of upward mobility. And here to speak first for the motion, Elise Gould. She is senior economist and director of health policy at the Economic Policy Institute. Ladies and gentlemen, Elise Gould.
Let's start with the first part of the proposition. Research from a multitude of government and academic sources have indisputably found that income inequality has increased over the last generation. That is an established fact. We know from research that rising income inequality has not helped grow the size of the economy and has likely even harmed growth. This makes the rise in inequality a zero-sum game at best. Since inequality means that the larger shares are flowing to the top, the middle and bottom continue to get squeezed. Those consequences aside, the one cost we're discussing today is reduced access to the American dream. The most common concept economists use to measure upward mobility is intergenerational mobility. This is the extent to which your parents' economic position determines your position in adulthood. If your position on the earnings, income, or wealth scale is largely a function of your birth, then even the most talented coming from the lower rungs of society will have a hard time achieving success. Conversely, little correlation between parents and children means that one's economic fate can be directly determined through intelligence and hard work. The fact that one's economic position in childhood determines one's position in adulthood more so in the US than in many advanced countries. We have less mobility here than in Denmark, Norway, Finland, Sweden. We have less mobility than Australia, Japan, New Zealand, Germany, Spain, France. Let me talk for a moment about our peer to the north, Canada. Canada actually looks a lot like us, both in economic regime and in its diversity. But family background is twice as important in determining children's success in the US than in Canada. Furthermore, among our peers, we are the most unequal society, and we have seen the greatest growth in inequality. Janet Yellen recently reiterated the fact that lower economic mobility is found in countries with higher income inequality. Opportunity for many often looks like education. Over time, high-income parents are making increasingly larger and larger investments in their children. And that's a good thing, but lower-income families simply cannot afford to make those same investments. And those investments pay off. It may come as no surprise the more affluent students score better on standardized tests. A recent study actually renamed the Scholastic Aptitude Test the Student Affluent Test, and it's a self-reinforcing cycle. What is even more troubling for society that defends the reality of the American dream is that low-scoring, high-income students are more likely to graduate from college than high-scoring, low-income students. That is, by definition, not about ability, it is about income. Everyone can't be in the top 1%, and we can all name stories of children who did succeed against all odds. But it's against the all odds part that we're here to talk about today. Has living in an increasingly unequal society made it harder to climb the rungs of the ladder? Unambiguously, the answer is yes.
Thank you, Elise Gould.
Coming up next, from the movie, The Lion in Winter, Queen Eleanor lectures her sons on world peace, delivered by Katharine Hepburn.
A knife! He's got a knife!
Of course he has a knife. He always has a knife. We all have knives. It's 1183 and we're barbarians. How clear we make it. Oh, my piglets, we are the origins of war. Not history's forces, nor the times, nor justice, nor the lack of it, nor causes, nor religions, nor ideas, nor kinds of government, nor any other thing. We are the killers. We breed wars. We carry it like syphilis inside. Dead bodies rot in field and stream because the living ones are rotten. For the love of God, can't we love one another just a little? That's how peace begins. We have so much to love each other for. We have such possibilities, my children. We could change the world.
And now, back to the debate. Does income inequality impair the American dream?
And that is our motion. Income inequality impairs the American dream of upward mobility. And here to speak against the motion, Scott Winship. He is the Walter B. Wriston Fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Scott Winship.
First, I agree that there is a lot of income inequality in the United States. There's a lot of income inequality on this stage. In my mind, if income inequality were impairing the American dream of upward mobility, you ought to see two things jump out at you in the very big literature that we've got on this question. The first thing you would expect to see is that over the period where inequality was growing in the United States, that you would see falling upward mobility. Now, the consensus from a dozen studies is easily summarized by the conclusion from the most recent paper that came to this conclusion. And I'll just quote, it found that mobility has remained remarkably stable over the second half of the 20th century in the United States. That finding is from Berkeley's Emmanuel Saez, who along with Thomas Piketty, who's the most famous economist of the year for sure, they're the two who developed the top 1% estimates that we all have seen everywhere. So that's his conclusion. The second conclusion you would expect to see is that places with a lot of inequality would have lower mobility. And you heard Elise mention that the U.S. has less mobility than other countries. That was certainly the conventional wisdom, I would argue, until this year. In a paper published this year, a Canadian economist named Miles Korak, what he did in this newest paper is to team up with an American economist and a Swedish economist. And the three of them looked at their own countries, compared mobility across them, and they found, quote, "We find almost no differences in upward mobility between Canada, Sweden, and the United States." Okay, my opponents want you to believe that if the top 1% hadn't made as much in the past 35 years, that the bottom and the middle would have made more. But research, again, finds that in rich countries, those that experience bigger increases in inequality have experienced bigger income gains at the bottom and in the middle. So essentially, if you enlarge the pie enough, the economic pie enough, then the poor and middle class actually can get more pie, even if their slice becomes skinnier. If you claim that absent rising inequality, the middle class would have had thousands of dollars more than they did, there are a couple of really big assumptions hidden behind that. One is that if we had capped the incomes at the top, that the economic pie would have become just as big as it actually did. The second assumption is that if we had capped those incomes, essentially the proceeds would be equally distributed across the population. Now, in actuality, what would likely happen is we'd be shifting incomes to knowledge workers and professionals who are in the upper middle class or in the rest of the top 10%. So as you listen to the arguments from the other side, I hope you continue to ask yourself that if income inequality hurts opportunity, why is it so hard to find that link when you look across time and look over space? The answer is that the motion on the table that income inequality impairs the American dream of upward mobility is intuitive, but wrong, and that's why you should vote against it.
I'm John Donvan, and you're listening to Intelligence Squared US. Stay with us. Hello, I'm John Donvan, moderator of Intelligence Squared US. Join us online at iq2us.org to vote on the motion and keep the debate going. And a reminder of what's going on. We are halfway through this opening round of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate. I'm John Donvan. We have four debaters, two teams of two, fighting it out over this motion. Income inequality impairs the American dream of upward mobility. You have heard from the first two debaters, and now on to the third. I'd like to welcome to the lectern Nick Hanauer. He is a co-founder and partner at the venture capital firm Second Avenue Partners and author of the book, The Gardens of Democracy. Ladies and gentlemen, Nick Hanauer.
Let me start tonight by sharing some IRS data. In 1980, the top 1% of Americans shared 8.46% of national income. By 2007, it had risen to 22.86%. During the same time, the bottom 50% of Americans' share of national income fell from 17.68% to 12.19%. And then in 2008, remember 2007, before those were the good old days, things went really bad for the American middle class. The distance an American child needs to go to get from the bottom to the top in our society is staggering. CEOs used to make 30 times the median wage, now earn 300 to 500 times. But there are two fundamentally different arguments inequality deniers make. The first is that it doesn't exist. The second is that it exists, but it's actually really, really good for the economy and the middle class. The idea, of course, is that when the rich get richer, that's good for the economy and for the middle class and for mobility. And this, of course, is the trickle-down economics lie. Capitalism needs inequality to grow, just like plants need water to grow, but in precisely the same way that too much water kills plants by drowning them, too much inequality kills capitalism by drowning the middle class. Ed and other inequality apologists present us with a false choice. Extreme and rising inequality is necessary to create adequate incentives for innovation and risk-taking, and that without these extreme incentives, it will all disappear. He will tell you that anything we do to blunt inequality, like raising the taxes on the rich or improving labor standards for the poor to increase wages, will kill the economy and mobility. This is utter nonsense. Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, Sam Walton, they all started their companies when taxes were twice as high as they are today, theoretically with half the incentive. Did they make some sort of cosmic mistake? Clearly, people are responding to incentives, just not the ones Ed thinks. The biggest incentive in a market economy is the market size. And the more money most people have, the bigger the opportunity and the bigger the incentives are to invest and innovate. Ed and his trickle-down ilk believe that capital is all that matters, but we are awash in capital. American companies are currently sitting on $2 trillion worth of cash. At the same time, the cost to innovate has fallen exponentially. It took $1 million to start Amazon.com. In our economy, growth is dependent on how many innovators and consumers we include in the economy. The economy isn't the bank accounts of the rich. It is the dynamic feedback loop between sellers and buyers. This means that the more people we include in our economy as robust innovators and affluent consumers, the faster it grows and the bigger it gets. That's why rising inequality is terrible for the economy and for the American dream of upward mobility. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick Hanauer. And that is our motion, income inequality impairs the American dream of upward mobility. And here, as our final debater against the motion in this opening round, to argue against it, Ed Conard. He is author of the book Unintended Consequences, Why Everything You've Been Told About the Economy is Wrong, and he's a former partner at Bain Capital. Ladies and gentlemen, Ed Conard.
I almost feel like I don't have to speak. Nick said it all for me. But Nick pushes you off what this debate is really about. It's whether income inequality impairs mobility. And if it did, there'd be telltale signs that Nick wants to overlook. The first is that we've seen a lot of growing inequality, but all the evidence says mobility has not declined. We've transferred more to the poor. That should increase mobility. It hasn't. We've spent more on education. That should significantly increase our test scores. It hasn't. So we may not have found a way to increase mobility, but we have found a way to increase the living standards of the poor, and that's by growing our economy. So this debate really isn't about whether income inequality impairs mobility. This debate is really about whether the success of America's top earners hurts the middle and working class. Now, our opponents see the economy as a pie to be divided. They believe that Steve Jobs' success reduces the income of everybody else. The more he gets, the less everybody else gets. We see his success as growing the economy and the demand for labor. Now, it's true. Productivity is growing faster than median wages. Our opponents see this as evidence that lesser-skilled employees no longer share in the success of our economy. They overlook the fact that growth can manifest itself in two ways. Where the supply of labor is restricted, like it was in the 1950s and 60s, it'll drive up wages. But where the supply of labor is unrestricted, like it is today, it'll drive up employment. The baby boom, the increased participation of women in the workforce, immigration, and growing trade deficits have created an enormous increase in supply in labor. And as a result, employment grew instead of wages. U.S. employment has grown 50% since 1980, twice as fast as Germany and France, three times faster than Japan. And America has achieved this employment growth at median incomes that are 20 to 30% higher than Germany, France, and Japan. No other economy has done more to help the middle class and working poor than the U.S. economy. In the real world, Germany, France, and Japan all distributed income more equally, and none of them produced faster employment growth than America, nor, despite more restricted supplies of labor, did they grow their median incomes faster than the United States since the early 1990s. In the academic world, there have been no less than six highly regarded cross-country studies on the effect of income inequality on growth by economists at Harvard, MIT, the OECD, the World Bank, the IMF. All of them have reached the same conclusion. Inequality accelerates growth in high-wage economies. The IMF's most recent study, whose headlines insisted that redistribution does not slow growth, admitted redistribution above the 75th percentile is indeed harmful to growth, as the Okun big trade-off suggests. Guess which country's at the 75th percentile? The United States. So please, don't succumb to our opponents' divisive politics. Even if you support higher taxes, the success of America's top earners is an asset, not a liability. Vote against the motion that success impairs upward mobility.
Thank you, Ed Conard. And that is our motion, income inequality impairs the American dream of upward mobility. And that concludes round one.
Now his reputation is left in shreds. What a crime!
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.